Ash, have you done a direct consumer test?
I'm a little hesitant because I don't want my DNA available in databases or being sold to other companies, because it's not just my DNA, it's also my family's. And I've heard that some companies sell consumers' data and we don't really know how it could be used in the future.
I think that's valid in a lot of people's concerns, and that's why Secret Sequence started. They don't ask for your name, address, or any personal information. And most importantly, like you pointed out, they don't sell your data. It remains private. So if you listeners want to check it out, Secret Sequence is offering you an exclusive $25 off two kits or more, which you can redeem at secretsequence.com with code DNA today.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, genes of you, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemicals, DNA. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemicals.
Woo! Go Michael!
Well, that was awesome. You're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Tanin. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health, usually through conversations with leaders in genetics, such as genetic counselors, like almost what we are, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. Today is a different kind of episode where we are recapping the National Society of Genetic Counselors annual conference that was held in Salt Lake City, Utah this year. And I'm joined by a couple of friends, as you already heard, from my class at Sarah Lawrence. Thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us. I'm Michael Pennycad, originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I've been living in New York City for the past 5 years.
And I'm Ashlyn Enochian from Brighton, Michigan, also currently living in New York City for grad school.
And fun fact, I was actually Ashlyn's teacher for chemistry lab while she was in college.
You're aging yourself.
Well, despite this age gap, it was all of our first time at the conference. So at the end of the show, we're also going to offer a few tips for people going in the future and things that maybe we wish we knew before we attended our first conference.
Yeah.
At this year's conference, we celebrated 40 years of NSGC.
Woo!
We heard from three presidents, our profession surpassed 5,000 genetic counselors, and now we have 45 genetic counseling programs in the United States and 40 international genetic counseling programs.
And that's what I was really surprised by, because I remember, like, I think when we started grad school, there was like 37-ish mm-hmm. programs, or when we were applying, and now we're up to 45 in the U.S. But hearing that there's 40 international genetic counseling programs, I was like, wow, I want to know all of these programs, because I feel like I only know a few of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for those that don't know, the conference is a 4-day event, like Tuesday to Friday, and the sessions can start as early as like 7 in the morning and go until like 9 at night, and there's even parties at night hosted by a lot of the labs. So it's a really chock full conference of so much information, and for some parts you have to decide what session you're going to, and there's multiple options. So because of all this, and that this is only a half hour show, we're going to just do some highlights and talk about a few of the sessions we were able to attend. And for more information, you can go on nsgc.org for, you know, lots more, but we're just going to talk about certain sessions. And Michael, I think one of your favorites was the BRCA debate.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I went to, and it really, I think really was the highlight of my conference outside of maybe some of the parties. But, you know, and this is not an exhaustive recap. I'm by no means an expert, but I am really interested in cancer. So some of the most important points and interesting moments I picked out, I'll kind of touch on. But so this really was a debate. There was Dr. Mark Robson from MSK, Dr. Peter Beisch, I think I'm saying that right, from Dallas Surgical Group, Sue Friedman, who's a patient advocate, founder of FORCE, which is a really awesome organization. And it was moderated by Dr. Lisa Medlensky, and open and closed by Dr. David Uhus, I think I'm saying that right as well, from Johns Hopkins. So really the main question was, should all women with breast cancer have genetic testing? The important points that were touched on was, what's the clinical utility of testing? What does informed consent look like? Is this testing research? Is it diagnostic? You know, are we talking about concordant results versus discordant results? What do we do with that? And really, what's the accessibility of this testing? How much information are we providing to patients? And then lastly, how do we shape provider education? And how do we utilize the genetic counselor skill set and time that they're spending to better utilize that skill set for patients in this sphere?
And it was really cool that they were able to cover so many different aspects of this in such a short amount of time. It was only, what, an hour and a half, 2 hours?
Yeah, I felt like longer, honestly. It was personally riveting, but you know, it was cool to see a lot of different, you know, different opinions and different ways of thinking about it. Specifically, Dr. Robson, he kind of opened with this philosophical perspective of, autonomy versus utilitarianism. So this sort of personal decision, I'm going to do this testing for these reasons versus we're going to test you because it's best for mankind or best for the most people.
And right now we're at that point where people opt into this. So that's where Correct. We are now, but it was the debate of like, okay, we're looking at the future.
Right. If this is a screening test, something that Dr. Repson brought up, you know, a screening test, they have thresholds and you sort of recognize that some people will be missed. You know, you have this sensitivity and specificity of a screening test, you know, a mammogram, for example. Then there's also biomarker testing, and biomarker testing is used to determine treatment. So for breast cancer, we're looking for estrogen receptor, we're looking for specific hormone receptors, HER2.
And to see what type of breast cancer is in terms of like, if it's chemotherapy, radiation.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this was a specific type of chemotherapy, depending on what neoadjuvant therapy is best. And so that first line treatment, those biomarkers are used. And so really right now, BRCA1 and 2 status is not used as a treatment indication for a newly diagnosed patient. Beyond BRCA1 and 2, we're looking at all these moderate and low penetrance genes for these sort of bigger panels. And so this was sort of the second question, you know, should we be testing all breast cancer for not only BRCA1 and 2, but also CHEK2, PALB2, NBN, BRIP1, I mean, all of these sort of lower penetrance genes, what is the sort of ethics and cost effectiveness of doing that? Especially for older patients who maybe don't meet guidelines. So if they don't meet current guidelines and we're going to test them because they had breast cancer, what are the ethics of that?
And the difference of, like, you were talking about BRCA1, 2 being, you're saying high penetrance, meaning that they have a really high risk of developing breast cancer in their life, but this low penetrance means they have a lower risk of inheriting breast cancer, but developing breast cancer, comparing the two, that when we hear, oh, elevated risk, there's different levels of like how much elevated.
Right. There's also really data to show that some of these lower or moderate penetrance genes, they're affecting the risk, but we don't even think that they are the cause of someone's breast cancer. So when we look at BRCA in a breast cancer, that's sort of a diagnostic test. We say, you have a mutation in BRCA, BRCA1 or 2, and we feel like that is actually causative of your cancer. If you have a CHEK2 mutation, that probably modified that risk significantly enough that developed this cancer, but we're not quite sure that just that CHEK2 mutation is actually causative of your cancer. So we start getting into this idea of a diagnostic test versus a screening test versus a research test. A screening test really is, let's say you have someone with breast cancer and you do this expanded panel and you find an MLH1 mutation. Well, that doesn't make much sense because breast cancer isn't really in that Lynch spectrum. Did MLH1 cause the breast cancer? Really, it's a screening test and saying, hey, we found this incidental finding. And I think that is relevant, you know, for someone to find out as long as they were, you know, consented.
But Dr. Beisch raised a pretty good question. Don't we want to catch everyone possible with a gene mutation? Because the best way to treat cancer is to prevent it in the first place.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to Dr. Robson's point, trying to predict this individual risk from genes that we think are relevant is really tricky. And so, you know, for BRCA1 and 2, we're pretty confident in those, but something like RAD50 or even some of these individual SNPs that people are looking at, those are really kind of research tests. And so with these big panels, we're combining this diagnostic testing with screening testing and research testing. Mm-hmm. And especially when you look at concordant results, meaning like a breast cancer with a BRCA mutation versus a discordant result, which is like a, you know, MLH1 mutation with a breast cancer or a CHEK2 mutation with an ovarian cancer.
Genes that don't really match the right cancer that we were looking at.
And seems more like an incidental finding rather than a causative mutation. So Dr. Paish brought up a recent JAMA article highlighting the cost effectiveness of this expanded screening, talking about how whether we were looking for it or not, these expanded panels are preventing breast and ovarian cancer and they're preventing deaths in general. So it's cost effective, it's preventing deaths. I think that's a totally fair point, you know, in favor of this more universal screening. He made an interesting point. He said, if tests were $5 each, everyone would get one. And I don't really agree with that. I think that he was sort of simplifying things far too much, kind of talking about how guidelines are restricting testing to curtail costs, and that's the only reason that guidelines exist. And Dr. Rabin was sort of like, no, like, guidelines were not built for this financial purpose. They were built because we thought that BRCA 1 and 2 were this like over 90% lifetime risk, that like if you had it, you were absolutely gonna get cancer. And now we're starting to see individuals with BRCA1 mutations, you know, many who go their whole lives without developing cancer, that it's not this 100%, that it's closer to you know, there's a lot of different numbers now, but we were just talking earlier, even something like 60 to 80.
A lot of ranges going on there. It's hard to say exactly.
Right. During this sort of argument about, like, should we just ignore these guidelines and test everyone? Rob Pilarski, who is the co-chair of the writing committee for the NCCN guidelines, he stood up and got on the mic and he was like, we should be amending these guidelines, not just ignoring them. Like
we've worked so hard to get there.
Right.
And let's work with it.
Yeah. Like, they're not designed to exclude populations for benefit. He was like, they're providing parameters. Like, we don't perform breast MRIs on everyone, so, you know, these guidelines can be amended.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point, but aren't the current guidelines actually designed to find people who have a hereditary mutation?
Yeah, and they are. But Dr. Yu has reiterated that, you know, guidelines actually don't do a very good job at indicating who will test positive. Family history is one thing, but it does not actually do a good job of finding people who will have a mutation. And then Dr. Robson pointed out that testing positive doesn't really do a good job at indicating who will actually get cancer, which was sort of a mic drop moment. But, you know, he was pointing to all these individual risk using personal risk scores and all these different other things with these lower penetrance genes, that it's not as clear cut by just saying, oh, they meet criteria, we're going to treat them this way, that really there's this push for more personalized medicine. How do we treat this individual rather than, okay, they have this cancer at this age, we're going to treat them exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Another point that I don't know was made directly during the debate, but I heard a lot of people talking on, like, Twitter, on hashtag GC chat, saying, let's look at ovarian cancer as being kind of a parallel to this, and saying that universal testing of ovarian cancer patients has long been recommended in these guidelines we keep talking about from NCCN, mm-hmm. but yet we don't have 100% of patients doing testing. So let's look to see why that is. Is it because patients aren't being offered the genetic test even though they should be? Are doctors not providing the education around this? Are they providing it in a way that's biased? And how can we apply this learning and seeing how it works in ovarian cancer world and say, okay, let's learn from this and put it into what we're doing for breast cancer?
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes back to that sort of informed consent model. I think it's going to happen regardless. We're moving towards a more broader panel. Personally, I think that's okay, as long as we're providing that informed consent. What we have to make sure we're not doing is that we're not degrading these standards of informed consent. Since we're moving to this sort of unselected approach to at least BRCA1 and 2 and probably PALB2 as well, we have to make sure that we're providing adequate assent to this testing and also this informed consent to some of these moderate penetrance genes. And that if we're going to be moving toward this model, we're going to need either more genetic counselors or new technologies. Moving from this pre-test counseling, post-test counseling model to maybe a more abbreviated pre-test, and then utilizing the genetic counselor skill set to be more of a post-test model.
And there's so many ways that people were talking about doing that, and I wish we could do a whole episode just on that. Maybe we will at some point. But yeah, I think this just kind of stirred up a lot of debate, and it was at times controversial, which is always interesting to see different people get up there.
To kind of recap, the big need for provider education and the better utilization of that genetic counselor skill set, I think everyone kind of in the panel agreed that in the end, that's the big point.
And we'll work towards that.
Yeah.
It was also cool that during the conference, we not only heard from, like, a lot of genetic counselors, and Michael, you were talking about the physicians we heard from, but also patient advocates. So we heard from, one, you mentioned Sue Friedman from FORCE, but we heard from Dr. Sonia Vallabim, hopefully I'm pronouncing her name right, who is a patient advocate that had a family experience, and she kind of started her talk about her mother, who very quickly declined and passed away in less than a year of an unknown cause, and it happened very quickly. And the autopsy revealed that her mother had a genetic prion disease. This was found to be inherited. And so it's a fatal, untreatable neurodegenerative disease. And I think one of her main points that she brought up, kind of bringing up that she knew her audience was genetic counselors, is that she had a quote from a genetic counselor. It says, like, you know, there's nothing you can really do about this. And that it kind of irked her that she was like, what do you mean there's nothing I can do? Like, that's a very blanket statement, and that it's not a reason not to get tested or advocate or start research, which is, like, what she ended up doing. And she was very inspirational. She got a standing ovation at the end. And another quote I wanted to pull out that she shared is that she said, ocean of knowledge, you know, to get info that's in every cell of my body. So she had to, like, go through all of this information just to find out, is she positive, is she not? And then she kind of said, if I'm standing up here, obviously my results were positive. And she then went on to get her PhD and start research for this specific disease. So she is a researcher doing and trying to find a treatment for a disease that she is predisposed to. And another quote that was like inspirational to me was, who would care about this more than we do? Why not us? And so I think that just kind of like encapsulates like the energy she brought and the passion on stage and her focus on like a therapeutic strategy and like drug development. And it was cool to hear that the research that she's doing with mouse models that have like the same patients is doing like really well. So brief overview of kind of how this disease works, of it's a neurodegenerative disease. The prions are like proteins that are like found in the brain, and when they're disformed, other prions around them can also be disformed. So it's kind of a domino effect, and that's why this can happen like so quickly. So what they're doing is taking out those prions in the first place so that it's not causing this domino effect and this neurodegenerative disease and all the symptoms that go with that. And it was impressive that she already has, her FDA is like very supportive of everything they've been doing.
I thought it was truly amazing how both she and her husband completely switched careers. Like, they both had successful careers in completely different fields and both just switched and dedicated their lives after her diagnosis to contribute research to this disease after people had, you know, discouraged them. And they shared their story of using pre-implantation genetic testing and IVF to actually have their daughter. She shared that it was really difficult working with the healthcare system on a daily basis. She said she was constantly taking phone calls, having to step out of the lab, things like that, and how it was like kind of a burden. But she said the general process was super easy, right? This is a possibility for their family. But she also stressed the point that the cost of PGT and IVF is out of reach for most families.
And that her insurance, like she's from, or like lives in Massachusetts, at mm-hmm. least at the time that she was doing this, and like her insurance, she was able to go through, but she had to fight for coverage. Whereas like a lot of families may not even have that option to be able to have insurance cover it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She stressed the importance of, you know, being your own case manager and being a self-advocate, but not everyone has those skills or the confidence to stand up to the healthcare system, right? And advocate for themselves. So she just left us all feeling super inspired. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. Like you said, there's standing ovation at the end. If you guys are interested, there's like articles about her. She's been on the news. So she's just really, really phenomenal. There was actually another patient advocate who talked about his experience with PGT. He is a lawyer. He's probably in his 30s or so. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, relatively young, yeah.
And one night he just had sudden cardiac arrest. Thankfully, his wife was right next to him and essentially
performed CPR, like to wait for.
Exactly. And you know, so this is something where most people like don't make it through. He ended up getting to the hospital, recovered, and he was ended up diagnosed with long QT syndrome and found that there was a genetic diagnosis or genetic basis for it. And he was pointed in the direction of IVF, you know, similarly doing this PGT. And he was saying how this was something that he had never heard of before, something that he felt like he was lucky to have someone to talk to that would recommend doing something like this. But he said that he doesn't like feeling lucky in medicine because it means that millions of others are missing out mm-hmm. On this technology and these options. The previous advocate kind of touched on this as well, that people were saying, oh, it's really hard. This is like really complex and really difficult thing. That it wasn't, the difficult thing was not, you know, choosing to do this. You know, he was really passionate about being able to prevent his child from inheriting this disease, you know, that it wasn't going to be, I think what he said was written into his, you know, into his life, this medical disease written into his life.
It's not hard to decide, like, I don't want my kid to have heart issues. Like, that's kind of a straightforward thing if it's an option.
Yeah, but he was saying, you know, just in terms of accessibility, like, he's like, everyone should know about this. Like, everyone should have access to this. But like we were just mentioning, you know, with the insurance and healthcare and things like that, it's really not accessible for everyone. But really, you know, he was talking about conversations about reproduction being kind of shrouded by this stigma and this fear, but that really, like, the answer to this fear is just empathy and to kind of have some moral clarity, scientific clarity, empathy, and it's all about, like, disease prevention and sort of improving the lives of people really before they're born to sort of prevent these types of things.
And he had mentioned, too, that not only, like, you know, preventing his child from having to go through everything that he had been through, that if you're just looking at that financial bit, that was a step in the right direction because it actually like saves money long term, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he said like 1 month of treatment for someone who has a diagnosis of cystic fibrosis was essentially the same amount of money as having one cycle of IVF.
So just think about that 1 month. Like, someone doesn't live for a month with CF. Like, that's a lifetime. So, you know, financially, we're getting to a point where it's like, why not do this?
Right. And I think insurance companies will come around to the idea of, we would rather help prevent, and it's going to save money in the long run. So hopefully as this becomes more accessible and more well known to people, that it'll kind of become more of a standard of care if it's an option for people.
We just have to keep fighting the insurance companies until they like start agreeing with all of us, I think.
That's becoming one of our main jobs. I think.
I know, right? Fighting with insurance. I'm like, that really is like one of our main objectives, I guess, as genetic counselors. And the other kind of prenatal one that I attended that was really interesting to me, I think maybe the most interesting kind of new case or like kind of project was about in utero like stem cell transplant. And I mean, even the title alone, I was like, oh, I have to attend this. And so they talked about how they are doing this procedure where fetuses that are diagnosed with alpha thal major are being given stem cells from the mom's bone marrow. So, you know, if it's a pregnant woman, taking stem cells like from her bone marrow and giving that to the fetus through the umbilical cord. And they're doing this around like 18 to 26 weeks, which I realize is a range, but it's when the umbilical cord's more accessible. And the reason they're using more maternal stem cells is because the fetus is already exposed to a lot of maternal cells. And so there's gonna be less of an immune response of the fetus like fighting this, is saying like, oh, this is foreign, because they're already exposed to that. And I was just like blown away with how they showed a little girl, I don't know, I want to say 1-2 years old, that was totally like normal. She was intellectually normal, stable, meeting milestones. And we just don't hear of this. At least I hadn't heard of this before. I thought the alpha thal major was like lethal. Like, okay, when we hear this, that pregnancy is not going to make it to term. And having this intervention was like, wow, you can actually change the course of this pregnancy, and these kids are fine. And so this totally blew my mind, and it's really impressive like what they're doing, and that it's not just about alpha thal major, but how this can translate into other diseases. And they were also kind of like starting to look into that. It's FDA approved as of 2016, and this is out of UCSF, Center for Maternal Fetal Precision Medicine. And I don't know if recruiting is the right word for this, because they go through counseling and make sure that both parents are electing for this, but they're looking at prenatal genetic counselors saying like, you can talk to these like researchers and everything to see if this is a good fit for them. So I think that was just a really interesting lecture that I was like really surprised by.
I did my summer rotation in high-risk pregnancy, where I counseled a lot on teratogens. So I was super excited about the teratogen and maternal like fetal medicine lecture that focused on Zika and marijuana specifically. So when it comes to Zika in the past, it's been a huge hot topic in the news, especially when it comes to traveling, but specifically for pregnant women. So if you contract Zika, it's mostly asymptomatic. They quoted about 80% actually.
Which is really high.
I know, it's like much higher than you would think with all the hype like in the media, right? But it's mostly asymptomatic, but if you are symptomatic, it usually presents as flu-like symptoms, so people often don't even know.
Yeah, people get flu all the time. They're not like, oh, it's Zika.
Yeah, exactly, especially like, you know, what you're exposed to when you travel. So you might just be sick from that, but so it's kind of hard to pinpoint. But it's very uncommon that you would experience this severe disease. Death from Zika is very rare, so we're not always sure. Transmitted via mosquitoes, which is what they mostly talk about when you're traveling and in different countries, but it can also be transmitted sexually and from mother to baby in the congenital form. It's really difficult to make risk approximations for something like this. Like, how many cases are currently reported all over the world? Because we don't know how other countries' health data is actually collected.
So I didn't go to this one. What did they say to quote, like, risk-wise when we counseled about Zika?
So they gave us kind of a big range, but they were currently quoting about a 5 to 14% risk of Zika-related birth defects.
Which doesn't seem high, but they're really severe if they do have birth defects.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of similar to, like, rubella or the other things that we vaccinate for. You know, we see those congenital malformations kind of in patterns. Some of the known defects are microcephaly, brain and eye abnormalities, vision problems, hearing loss, and seizures. So it's super important, and they advise that we actually use the Center for Disease Control guidelines when you're looking to travel or looking to counsel on these kinds of things.
And an organization that's good for this that I feel like we should plug is Mother to Baby.
Yeah,
they're based in Connecticut. They came and spoke to our class when we're looking to like prevent pregnancies affected by this. If someone is known to be affected by Zika, so that the male partner wait 3 months until you're looking to conceive, 2 months for women. So a little bit difference there.
Mm-hmm. But aside from class, they gave us some really great counseling tips when traveling to another country with recent or some current outbreaks, which are listed usually on the CDC website. So you can use this insect repellent and you can even treat your clothing with this insect repellent. And they even talked about how sometimes when you wash the clothes, it still is like active. Wow. That was really interesting. We didn't really talk about that before. And they also said to look for weird areas of water, like puddles and things like that, and to try to drain those because that's where mosquitoes lay their eggs and where they'd be able to transmit the disease if the pregnant person was staying like kind of in that area.
So it sounds like prevention was really the main part of that for Zika.
Yeah, absolutely. It's prevention before going, you know, making sure like where you're traveling, talking to your doctor and things like that. But then also prevention of being pregnant when you're back.
So kind of two-pronged there.
Yeah, just like to kind of cover both your bases. And the other half of the presentation was on marijuana. So we need these discussions surrounding marijuana exposure and pregnancy because we're seeing increased use. We have way higher trends of self-reporting, especially with, you know, some states legalizing marijuana. People feeling more comfortable talking about it openly when they talk about kind of exposures during pregnancy. When we counsel, we can assume that many of our patients have ingested marijuana in some form during their lifetime. We're not saying this is always during pregnancy. It could be pre-pregnancy. It could be during the pregnancy when the person didn't know they were pregnant. So there's a lot of different situations that they were kind of talking about.
And did you learn more about the science behind like how this actually works? Because for me, it's like, okay, yeah, like you're maybe ingesting marijuana, but what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said there's a really big difference in kind of the form and the concentration of THC. They talked about a little bit of the science that I didn't know about called photocannabinoids. These are cannabinoids that occur naturally in the cannabis plant, and they act on the endocannabinoid receptors. And these receptors in the endocannabinoid system actually acts on appetite, pain, pleasure, mood, memory, and the immune system. So things that sometimes people like associate with marijuana use.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm hearing that THC is able to cross the placenta and blood-brain barrier to the pregnancy. So yeah. It makes sense that like it really could affect the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely know that, but we just don't know really to what extent.
And I've seen like some studies, and we were talking a little bit before the show, that there are correlations between marijuana and like preterm delivery, mm-hmm. fetal growth, low birth weight.
Yeah, similar to cigarettes.
Right, yeah. So that's a good way to kind of like link them together. Children that are followed long-term show some neurodevelopmental effects like hyperactivity, but again, that's more of a general thing that we see in the population anyway. So it's nothing specific like we see in, say, Zika, where we're like, oh, microcephaly or something where you can mm-hmm. pinpoint. But there seems to be kind of a dose response relationship there.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they really emphasize that we counsel on, is the dose-responsive relationship. But studies show mixed results, and there's no clear pattern of birth defects. Like with other teratogens, we can clearly see patterns.
And that's when it's easy to be like, oh, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And it's super easy to even convince people to stop ingesting certain things during pregnancy when we have the really clear patterns to counsel on. But this changing culture definitely calls for further research because a lot of the research studies they talked about were either small or had like very like discordant results between the studies. There's an association, and I would say personally that's like often a dangerous association, if I can go as far as to say that, between legalization and safety, where government legalization does not necessarily imply safety, but it's perceived that way by certain groups of people.
Because even think of like alcohol, like alcohol is legal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean pregnant women should drink it and pregnant women should not be drinking
Absolutely.
Alcohol.
But we can see such a distinct pattern with fetal alcohol syndrome that we're not really observing with marijuana at this current time.
And you wonder, like, will we mm-hmm. soon?
Yeah, they definitely, I can tell that's important. They're doing the research, but we just need a lot more of it. So they kind of gave us some main take-home points, which I thought were really useful in counseling in this new environment. The main take-home point was that currently there is not enough data to say that marijuana increases the average risk of birth defects, which we quote as 3-5% for all pregnancies.
So all pregnancies, regardless of any factors, just you're pregnant, this is your risk.
Yep, because there's always, you know, sporadic birth defects. So we're quoting that 3-5%, but we still are supposed to counsel on the dose-responsive relationship. People who use marijuana don't necessarily know how much THC they're actually ingesting as well. And that was a big point that they made, that THC content and the amount of THC in different products, depending on how you ingest it, has gone up steadily since the 80s. So things now have like much higher content.
Okay, but it sounds like there's still a lot of uncertainty. So like, how do we talk to patients about this?
So they quoted that during pregnancy, many women actually report vomiting and nausea. Of course, we know these things are, you know, normal symptoms of, you know, being pregnant.
Definitely.
And they cite that people use marijuana to help manage those symptoms, which that makes sense. But we actually need to counsel and be there for these women or these people and really just explore why people use during pregnancy and determine if there are alternate remedies that maybe won't pose such a risk to the pregnancy. So it's important to convey uncertainty and lack of data and discuss confounders in the studies, such as cigarettes or alcohol, which could have affected the results. And finally, it's really important to be including other specialists in these discussions because we are trained as generalists, but obviously we can't know everything. So for instance, we could offer more comprehensive care on the psychosocial side, bring in social workers, and maybe even consult with pharmacists for the effects of certain medications on pregnancy that may be teratogenic. Shout out to my amazing pharmacist parents.
Yeah, definitely. I know we're running a little long, but I really wanted us to just go over some conference tips of things that we kind of wish we knew going into the conference and for people that are hoping to go next year and looking to prepare for it. I love free stuff, I have to admit. So going to the exhibit hall is really cool because you get to go up to all the booths of a ton of different labs and other companies related to genetic counseling and collect that, but also get to talk to them and network. I'm a huge networker and take cool photos. Myriad had a really cool professional photo booth, so we actually all got professional photos done, which you can see on our social media and all of that. Another random tip is I'm always cold and the lecture halls are freezing, so wear layers.
Yeah, definitely, you know, like we mentioned before, it's so hard to get to every single thing. There are times where there's things happening at the same time. So prioritize the ones you want to go to, but also don't feel like you have to go to everything from 7 a.m. until 9 p.m. Prioritize the ones you want to go to. Usually you have to register for some of these lunch sessions and breakfast sessions and dinner sessions beforehand, but I found that if I just went and I stood in line, I could register on the spot as long as there was room, and I got in every single time I went, so definitely check that out.
So another pro tip is that we weren't sure if you could go to SIGs, but you can actually go to the special interest groups as students, or even if you're not in the SIG already, to just try to get involved, see what kind of research people are doing, what they're working on. And I actually was able to go with Kira to one that was on ART and infertility, and it just made us super motivated to get more involved.
And cool to just like meet people in person, especially people that like you follow on Twitter, for instance, of like hashtag GC chat. A lot of people I was able to meet either like at that SIG or just other points in the conference. And during the conference, it's really good if you're hopping on Twitter, either just reading what people are talking about for that side conversation or jumping in yourself. You can follow like hashtag NSGC, I guess next year it'll be 20, this year it was 19. And you can also ask questions during the presentation. And at the end, sometimes they'll be like, oh, we got a Twitter question. And so it's a really cool way to get involved and kind of have an extra experience to the conference.
And one of the most exciting areas of the conference hall was the job board.
As students.
So we are all looking at the jobs. Jobs are able to post kind of like recruitment flyers and their contact information on different like regions in the United States. And so you can kind of look at those. You know, they're hiring. Some of them show sign-on bonuses and kind of give you the insider to who you should be talking to for recruitment. And you can even give out your resumes if you're there, and you can even go to more individual, like private meetup groups. Sometimes they have even interviews that you can do while you're at NSGC, so you're doing less traveling during your second year.
And so there is so much information. We covered actually quite a lot in this episode. I'm kind of proud of us, how much we got through. But obviously, this is tip of the iceberg. So for more information, go to nsgc.org. Or check out the blog post associated with this episode, because we're going to have like the names of the presenters if we didn't end up mentioning them, and like way more information. That's all going to be at dnapodcast.com, and even hyperlinks to tweets maybe we mentioned during the show, mm-hmm. and other resources. Like I mentioned, Mother to Baby, I'll connect to that. And you guys are on Twitter, right?
Yep. So if you want to give me a follow, I'm just at Ashlyn Enochian.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Michael Pennycad.
And as I said, dnapodcast.com has all this information more, including their social media handles. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at DNA Podcast, and on Instagram at DNA Radio. That one's a little bit different. Someone stole my handle on that. And I want you to go to Instagram. I'll probably post on Twitter too, but I love Instagram at DNA Radio, because we're going to post the shirts that Ashlyn Enochian, sitting right here, designed for our class. That, because we're Sarah Lawrence College and we went to Salt Lake City, it's SLC, goes to SLC. And
aww.
She made this really cool logo, and I just want everybody to see it because she's an amazing graphic designer. So
thanks, Kira.
Yeah, and if anyone has questions on this episode, any other episodes, ideas, anything, you just want to say hi, thanks for doing the show, email in at info@dnapodcast.com. And that includes if you have a question for Michael or Ashlyn, I'll just forward that along.
You want me to sing your intro song?
Right. Yeah, we're going to get you graphic design jobs. We're going to get you some singing gigs. And before I forget, I also wanted to mention that if you're interested in Sarah Lawrence College, we all go to Sarah Lawrence College. We have our next open house on November 15th, and that is 6 to 8 p.m. at night. And I'm also going to link to the Facebook event. Thanks for listening, and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemicals, DNA. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemicals.
Have you guys started your holiday shopping yet?
Oh, no, I really need to.
It's always hard to come up with ideas, but I'm looking at really cool genetic-themed gifts.
A cool gift for families, actually, is the Ancestry Kit from Secret Sequence. You can find out where your family's from, including really specific regions.
And you can probably order for both your parents, because then you get to see both sides of your family.
Yeah, so when I did the kit, my top countries were Ireland, Britain, and Poland. And I knew about Ireland and Poland on my dad's side, but my mom's family we didn't know as well, so I learned mostly from Britain, and specifically a region my family lived in was Lancashire.
Oh, nice.
My grandparents are from four different countries, so I'm actually really curious to confirm what regions in each of those countries my ancestors are from. I'm glad I don't have to sacrifice having my private info in databases, because Secret Sequence doesn't sell it to other companies, so my data stays secure.
Well, sounds like you both found something great for everyone on your list.
Exactly. So if you guys want to try this as well, head over to secretsequence.com and use promo code DNA today for $25 off two kits or more. Doing this also supports the show. Again, it's the name of the show, DNA today at secretsequence.com for $25 off two kits or more. Thanks for listening and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.